If you were to complete this sentence, I picture God as, or my idea of God is, what would it sound like? In our culture, it would sound very different depending on who you ask that question to, because so many people have so many different ideas about God. If you were to ask people in the Athenian culture 2,000 years ago, you might surprisingly get the same kind of answers. There were the Epicureans that we talked about last week. These were the party animals of their day. They believed that we came about by a random chance of atoms coming together. There is no afterlife. There is no personal God. Then you had the pantheists of the ancient culture, the Stoics, who believed everything is God. The trees are God, you're God, everything material is God. And people had their own answers, and by the time of Paul the Apostle, it was a pick and choose kind of a culture. I found an article called Racing Toward 2001 that said, quote, "There are legions of believers, but not belongers out there. Individuals who increasingly feel free to construct their own worldview from many options present in society, rather than being bound by the orthodoxy of their particular faith. Without brand name loyalty, they are apt to pick up on anything from the expanding God shelf. They have their own private religions." George Barna called this a synthetic faith, and he said, looking toward the future, "It will be fascinating to watch people develop these new religious philosophies." Now, this was written several years back. As I read this, think how much of this is just common stuff today. "In all likelihood, people will seek a blend of elements that will give them a sense of control over life, personal comfort and acceptance, and a laissez-faire style philosophy. It's likely that from Christianity, they'll borrow Jesus' philosophy of love and acceptance. From Eastern religions, they'll borrow ideas related to each person being his or her own God, the center of the universe, capable of creating and resolving issues through his or her own power and intelligence. From Mormonism, they'll extract the emphasis upon relationships and the family toward establishing a greater sense of community." Today, the people's idea is that we're all traveling down a huge cosmic freeway, each in his own lane, only divided by little dotted white lines. It doesn't really matter what lane you're in. The freeway all goes to the same place. And people have their own personalized concepts of God, not realizing that it's idolatrous, and not realizing that though they talk about a God, God is unknown to them. It's an unknown God that they worship, much like the time of Paul the Apostle. We mentioned last week that Athens had between 25,000 and 30,000 statues, gold, silver, bronze, stone, ivory, all to various gods and goddesses of their culture. The false ideas that they had led them to false worship and a very unstable society. The Epicureans didn't agree with the Stoics with the Epicureans, and the people who worshipped at this temple versus another temple, they were all in conflict with one another. Nobody really knew where to land. I heard a story of a couple, a country couple. They had never really gotten out of their little hometown much. In fact, they were taking a flight overseas over to England. They had never been on an airplane before. And they're going in a jet aircraft from the United States over to England. They're halfway over the Atlantic. The captain gets on the intercom and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain. I regret to inform you that one of our three engines is conked out. Not to worry, we'll be there about an hour late. Everything will be fine." A couple hours more into the flight, he came on the intercom again and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is your captain again. I regret to inform you that the second of our three engines is conked out. Really shouldn't worry about anything, however. This has been known to happen. And we're going to arrive safely at our destination in England, but we'll be about 3 hours late." Of course, the guy who had never flown before in his naivete turned to his wife and he said, "You know, this is ridiculous. If this keeps up and that third engine goes out, we're going to be up here all night long." And it seems like that the Athenians could never land on any particular ideology. They all were in conflict with one another. They were naively worshiping false gods. and false systems. And so Paul the Apostle came on the scene in Athens. He noticed all of this around him, and he approaches this culture, and he shares the gospel with him. And today we're going to examine what he said, and we're going to read from verse 22 through 34. But look at verse 21. Let's start there, because this was the problem that he was facing. For all of the Athenians and the foreigners who were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. It sounds like a talk show, doesn't it? They've heard it all before, and they just want anything new and unusual and outrageous, just put it on. And so Paul was there in this polytheistic, hedonistic, and even pantheistic culture. And he's going to speak about the true God. Now, as we go through this morning, there's three things that emerge. Paul's approach to his culture. The approach of Paul. Secondly, the address about God. And finally, the answer of the people to Paul the Apostle. I want to begin, even though I said we begin at verse 22, with verse 19. The approach of Paul the Apostle was one of invitation, not intimidation. Notice they asked him to do the speaking. They took and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new doctrine is of what you speak? For you are bringing some strange things to our ears. Therefore, we want to know what these things mean." Then Paul stood, verse 22, in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I was passing through and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To the unknown God.' Therefore, the one whom you worship without knowing, him I proclaim to you." Notice how Paul begins the message. They asked him. He didn't just burst in there. He didn't wave his arms. He didn't put them down. He didn't condemn them. In fact, he opens up his message with almost a compliment to disarm them. "You know, I was looking around, I noticed that you're a bunch of very religious folks." So he opens up with a very mild-mannered approach, first of all, and it was done by invitation. Much like he did in verse 18, which we read last week, when he was in the marketplace and he spoke with whoever happened to be there. His approach was conversational, not contrived. It was natural. It was not weird. When I lived in Huntington Beach, I sought one evening to go out and share the gospel on the Huntington Beach Pier, where there's a lot of people with a lot of different ways of thinking and living. And they just kind of all hang out there to exchange their thoughts and their lifestyles. And so I went out there just to naturally schmooze through the crowd and share the gospel. What arrested my attention was this evangelist who had the Bible high in the air, and he was yelling at people. I mean, he would get in their face and he would, you know, grimace at them and he'd yell at the top of his lungs. And he had one surf kid by the arm, kind of bent back and forced him on the ground. Now, I was watching the face of this young surfer to see if he was really endeared to this style of evangelism and if it was really making an impact in his life. And of course, it wasn't. He just wanted to get free. Then one night I was here in Albuquerque outside of Popejoy Hall by the university. A couple guys stood up on a bench and they raised their voice at the top of their lungs and they started yelling, you know, "You're going to hell," and "You this," and "You that." And I again watched the crowd to see what is the response of these people. Are they being drawn into this message? And of course, they were not. Now, Jesus said that if you're a Christian, you're going to be persecuted. But make sure that you are being persecuted for the right reason. He said, you'll be persecuted for righteousness' sake, not gooniness' sake. Make sure that it's your righteous, godly lifestyle and a clear-cut message of the gospel. If you're going to get persecuted for anything, make sure that it's for that. I would say that God wants sharpshooters, not machine gunners. You can pull out the gospel gun and boom, 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 and impress people with your anger and your angst. But it's another thing to impress them with that sharp shooting lifestyle that cuts to the heart. Paul did that. Paul the Apostle later on wrote about sharing the gospel in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 14. I'm going to read it to you in the Living Bible. Listen to this. But thanks be to God, for through what Christ has done, he has triumphed over us, so that now wherever we go, he uses us to tell others about the Lord and to spread the gospel like a sweet perfume. Isn't that great? We're to share the gospel like a sweet perfume. Or as Jesus put it, you are the salt of the earth. And we know that salt creates a thirst. Thirst is a precursor to having that thirst quenched by the living water. So ask yourself, am I creating a thirst? Do people look at me and ask for the water of life because I spread his word wherever I go like a sweet perfume for the parched lives of the people who are around us? The second thing I'd like you to notice about his approach is that he came to their level. He approached them at their level. What I mean by that is that he took something very familiar with their culture. That was his point of reference. That was his starting point that he began to share the gospel with them. As you examine the message, this is not a canned message. He never shares this message again with anybody, except for a few important elements. It's a tailor-made message for the people of Athens in particular who had that culture. Now, as we begin what he said in verse 22 and 23, 24, he uses their culture as a starting point. Notice, as I was passing through, verse 23, and considering the objects of your worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, Agnosto Theo, to the unknown God. Therefore, the one whom you worship agnostically, literally, without knowing, him I proclaim to you. He began with something they were all familiar with. There was that inscription in Athens to the unknown God. By the way, there were many statues, not just one. Many statues in Athens with the inscription to the unknown God. And you might wonder, where did this come from? Well, it had a history. And this is why Paul chose it. About 600 years before this, a Cretan poet named Epimenides was summoned to Athens because there was a pestilence that swept through Athens and people were dying and they couldn't figure out what to do. The Cretan poet Epimenides did something that worked. He took a flock of sheep, black and white ones, and let them loose through Athens wherever they hung out, wherever they sat down. The statue closest, the shrine or temple closest to that sheep. They took that sheep and they sacrificed it to that god. If that sheep would sit in the middle of nowhere, they would erect a statue there to an unknown god and sacrifice to the unknown god. According to the history of the Athenians, the pestilence lifted and the people were cured because they sacrificed to an unknown god. With that in mind, he's saying, yeah, there's a God that you guys don't know anything about, that you got a statue to him all over the place. The God that you don't know, the God that Epimenides spoke about, I'm going to tell you who he is. So he used their culture as a starting point. He noticed they were very religious. He noticed that they were incurably religious, but they were still empty. They had so many different gods and belief systems. But the God they should know about was unknown to them. You know, I find religion to be like that today. There's people who are religious. They have their religious systems. They have their habits of every Sunday and every Sunday night and every Wednesday night and they're on and on. But often people are just outwardly religious, but inwardly they don't know God. And I have found that religious people are the hardest people to preach the gospel to. They don't admit that they have a need. They think, look it, I'm religious. And Paul says, you know what? You are religious. But there's this God that you don't personally know. And I'm going to let you know who he is. In verse 28, I draw your attention to that. Well, let's just read on. Verse 24, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. And he is made from one blood, every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth. And he has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord in hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as some of your own poets have said, we also are his offspring. Now what Paul does in verse 28 is he quotes two people they were familiar with. It's not a canned message. It's a very relevant message. He quotes, the first part of verse 28 was a saying given by Epimenides himself, the Cretan poet. In him we live and move and have our being. The second quotation, we also are his offspring, was a quotation from a third century poet, Aratus of Soli, who said concerning Zeus, the chief of all gods, in Zeus we are his offspring. And of course, Paul is taking this out of context on purpose to show that we are the offspring of this unknown, personal, one singular God. Now, what this did is when they heard this, they said, oh, this guy is one of us. He knows our history. He knows our culture. He's taken the time to listen. The most effective way to share the gospel is to first find out what the questions people have. Don't just come in with the answer. Listen. He examined their culture. It would be like somebody in America quoting Time or Newsweek or saying Kurt Cobain, before he committed suicide, said thus and so. And people who are familiar with that would be taken in by it. And that's what Paul the Apostle does here. We're talking here about packaging. The gospel is never changing. You don't have to make a new product. The gospel is powerful. The packaging of the gospel, however, changes. It should change. We shouldn't try to reach 1990 people with 1940 techniques or 1920 music or 1830 this and that. The packaging should change, but the message should never change. And that's what Paul does here. He's being very relevant to the culture. You know, I fear that a lot of people come to churches or read Christian literature or listen to Christian programs on the radio or on television. And, you know, it's a yawn session to a lot of them. It's boring. It's irrelevant. It doesn't really have to do with their life. There's real people with real questions and real issues out there. And Christians need to scratch them where they itch on those issues. And Paul the Apostle does exactly that. You might say that Paul was a man of the word and a man of the world. Not a worldly man, but a man who was in touch with his world. I think Paul would have agreed with the preacher who, when he was asked, well, how do you prepare for a message? He said, I have in one hand the open Bible and in the other hand the open newspaper. That's how I preach my messages. He combines both of those elements. I found an illustration about this that I think fits. Igor Stravinsky, the great Russian composer, wrote his Ebony Concerto for a jazz band called the Woody Herman Herd, one of the swinginest bands around then. And they got together to perform and to record this, but there was this severe communication problem. On one hand, you have a classically trained musician who knew all of the turns and twists, and then you've got this kind of garage band variety who felt the music. They were just as good, but they weren't classically trained. And there was this communication gap. Stravinsky tried to tell them something. They couldn't figure out what he was saying, and they didn't get very far. So Woody Herman called his longtime friend, Neil Hefti, and said, Neil, would you talk to the maestro and find out what we're supposed to do and tell us? He said, sure. So we went to him and said, maestro, you tell me exactly what you want from them, and I'll try to communicate the message. Stravinsky said to him, I want a sudden sforzanda followed by a subito decrescendo. Hefti said, no problem, gotcha. And he went back to the band, and he turned to them, and he said, bend it, boys. And they got the message. All of that meant to them, bend it, boys. The people in our culture need to know what the message is before we can expect them to respond to it. And people talk differently today. They think differently. They don't say, excuse me, sir, anymore. It's like, hey, dude. It's a different culture. We have to know what it is. And Paul knew and approaches culture like that. Then I want you to notice that Paul begins in verse 24 with a big God. A big God. The approach to his culture, a humanistic culture, was that God is big. And he begins with a big God and works down to small man's response to a big God. Now, I bring this to your attention because the Greeks did the opposite. The Greeks, like humanists today, begin with man and they build their worldview outwardly and upwardly by observation, by their own logic, their own experience. And so if you're going to be spiritual, said Kierkegaard, you've got to take a blind leap away from logic. And if you are logical, says David Hume, then you're not going to be very spiritual. You're going to only make observations in your own society and build outwardly. Paul didn't do that. Paul begins with a huge God in contrast to their thousands of gods, in contrast to the Epicurean and the Stoic philosophy, and says, this is God. He is the creator of life. And now here is your response to that God. The gods of Greece were amplified humanity. They were pictures of men and women or statues of them. Amplified humanity whom they had made. He's saying God is greater. We can't make God. God made us. One of the problems we have when we share the gospel is that we make God small, inept, one of many. Take your choice. Not Paul. He was very, very different. God was big, and he begins with him. Robert Dick Wilson, who, by the way, was one of the greatest defenders of the Christian faith, was a professor at Princeton University. And one of his former students was invited to come back 12 years after he graduated to Princeton and give a message in the chapel. He stood up to preach, and that day Robert Dick Wilson sat in the front row to listen. After the message, he went to his former student and he said, quote, "Now if you come back again, I will not come to hear you preach. I only come once. I am glad that you are a big godder. I am glad that you are a big godder. When my boys come back, I come to see if they are big godders or little godders. Then I know what their ministry will be like." And the student didn't quite get it. He said, "Well, what do you mean? Explain that to me, big god or little godder." Robert Dick Wilson said, "Well, some men have a little god and they are always in trouble with him. He can't do any miracles. He can't take care of the inspiration and transmission of the scriptures to us. He doesn't intervene on behalf of people. They have a little God, and I call them little godders. Then there are those who have a great God. He speaks, and it is done. He commands, and it stands fast. He knows how to show himself strong on behalf of them that fear him. You have a great God, and God will bless your ministry." Then he turned, said, "God bless you," and he walked out. Are you a big godder? Or are you a little godder? When problems come, it's, "Oh, God's so distant, this is so big," or, "God is so big, no problem for him." We often reduce God to a manageable bite, a manageable size, a convenient size that just fits us. We create him in our image. I picture God as, my idea of God is, and then we worship that little ideology. I think that's sort of what people do today often when they speak about God. I've told you before of that shrine in Kyoto, Japan called the Temple of 1,000 Buddhas. You walk inside, it's a Buddhist shrine, but there are 1,000 different depictions of Buddha, each with a different look on his face. And people will go in there and scan the walls until they find the Buddha that looks most like them, and they will worship them, that image. We are worshiping a God that we have created many times in our image rather than God for who he really is. Okay, that's his approach. Invitation, not intimidation, begins at the culture in a very relevant kind of a way, and a big, big God. Now, the address about God is found in verses 24 through 31. It's five sentences only, but it's packed full of information. In verse 24, Paul says, God is the creator. God who made everything, who made the world and everything in it, since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Now, what do you think the Epicureans were thinking? They thought we came about as a random chance of atoms coming together. There's no afterlife. There's no singular God. What do you think the Stoics thought at this point? The Stoics didn't believe in a singular creator God, but everything in creation is God. They were pantheists. He's saying, no, God made everything in it. I think Paul's point is well taken. I think the culture of Athens was much like the culture today. You still have people who say, we weren't created. That's such an outmoded thing. We dealt with that in the courts a long time ago. We're just a random configuration of atoms. A cosmic accident. Fortuitous occurrences of accidental circumstance. Everybody knows that. Now, if I were to stand here and say, this watch that I have, let me tell you how it happened. It came about by, it's made out of leather and metal. And what happened is millions of years ago, rocks on a riverbed were just tumbling down and an explosion of gas happened. And over millions of more years, metals came together in glass form because there's a lot of that stuff and magma from the earth and a volcano, boom. And after millions of years, suddenly somebody heard a tick. And it was this watch. No joke, it just happened that way. You'd say, well, you're an idiot. You would say, as I look at that watch, it has a design to it, which makes me think there must be a designer behind the design. I infer from design that a designer exists. And the designer puts his name on the watch, in this case, Harley-Davidson Motorcycles. They've designed it. And so you look at this product, the human body, 10 billion neurons in your brain. Sending and receiving information. 2 million tiny cells on the skin, sweat glands. 2 million of them, 3,000 per square inch. You've got a pump inside that pushes blood 168 million miles a day. It reflects incredible design. You can say, yeah, you know, millions of years ago, that little guy with the tail on it that slimed up out of the water, and then boom, here we are. I'd say the same thing about the guy with the watch who said what he said. Design reflects designer. Paul says, God made the heavens and the earth. And if you look at the Milky Way with its 100 billion stars, or you look at the 800,000 cataloged insects in the biosphere, you go, wow. Either chance, I don't think so, or design. Now, that's not a popular subject. It's more intellectually correct and politically correct to say we evolved. I like what the one woman said to that. She said, if evolution holds, then why do mothers still only have two hands? That's a pretty good argument, actually. Sir Frederick Hoyle, the professor of astronomy at Cambridge University, speaking about evolution, put it this way, and he's a modern contemporary one, that the chance that higher life forms might have emerged this way through evolution is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. Now, here's Paul's point. God has made everything. He's the creator. Because he's the creator, it's absurd to think that you can minimize him to a little shrine or a temple. You can't do that. A temple cannot hold God. I remember when I was a kid, people told me church was the house of God. And as a little kid, I'd run up and down the aisles, and some adult would grab me and go, "You're running in the house of God." So I thought God lived in that place. A building is not the house of God. You who are Christians are the house of God. This is just a building for the sake of meeting. There's nothing hallowed about it until you, God's holy people, get in it. That's Paul's point. He's the creator. Secondly, he's the sustainer. Verse 25, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything. Can you imagine God needing something? Since he gives to all life, breath, and all things. You know, it's ludicrous to say that the creator and sustainer of life himself needs to be sustained. So here you Athenians are with your statues, and you put little pieces of food in front of the statue because those little gods get hungry. God doesn't need to be sustained, and yet, when you look at some ministries today, you would get the idea that God does need support. Now, God is broke this week, and you got to send in that love check this week, or this ministry, God's work is going to close. Hey, people start thinking of God as a beggar, as if he needs something. That's a role reversal. God is the creator and sustainer, and he sustains and supports us. We don't support God. God is not in any danger of going under. Business is good in heaven. God is in perfect control, and that's Paul's point. If he's the creator, then he can maintain his creation. He gives life and breath to all. And aren't you glad he does, that we live in an ordered universe? Aren't you glad that we're 93 million miles away from the sun? Because it has a surface temperature of 12,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And if we were just a little closer or a little further in orbit, we would be dead. We wouldn't exist. We'd either burn to death or freeze to death. It just so happens that we're 93 million miles away from that globe. Aren't you glad that the oceans aren't any deeper or higher than they are, because the oxygen and carbon dioxide would be so imbalanced that the biosphere wouldn't exist? Aren't you glad that the tilt of the earth is 23 and a third degrees off of its axis, giving us an equilibrium of four seasons? That's an ordered universe. God sustains it. Verse 26 and 27, Paul mentions that God is the ruler, notice, and he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek the Lord and hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. Paul is saying God is in control of history overall. God is capable of throwing down nations and raising them up. Daniel is a perfect example of that. So many predictions were given of the kingdoms that would fall and the kingdoms that would rise before the kingdoms ever existed. And names of emperors were even given. So history is his story. God is sovereign over his creation and over history. And the point Paul is making here is that God is creator, sustainer, and ruler, and God put a hunger and a thirst, an empty spot, in the creation. He called it in Corinthians, we are subject to vanity. We have an empty spot that needs to be filled. We want God's rulership over us, but sin has so blinded us that all we can do at best is to grope for God in hopes that we might find him. Though, God isn't far. Every now and then somebody will say, well, I can't make a decision. I'm searching for God. God isn't lost. Man is lost. And by the way, God is not far away. You don't have to take 4 steps, 12 steps, 24 steps. It's 1 step. He's not far. All you have to do is turn. The Bible calls it repentance. And say, Jesus, I'm a sinner. Receive me. Or, yeah, receive me as your child, because I receive you as my Lord and Savior. God isn't far from any one of us. God put that empty spot within our hearts. Then in verse 28 and 29, he says God is the Father of all, in a creative sense. For in him we live and move and have our being, as also some of your own poets have said, for we also are his offspring. Therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something that is shaped by art and man's devising. God is the father of every person in a creative sense, not in a redemptive sense. We are not brothers and sisters with everybody in the world spiritually. We are physically, in that God has created people. So in a creative sense, God is the father of all. And since God is the father of all, and he is separate and distinct from his creation, and by this time the Stoics are going, I don't like this guy, because they were pantheists. But he's saying that we are the offspring of God. His point is an image. An image cannot correctly represent God. Now, there's a fundamental truth here, folks, that we just want to pass over as we move on. Any image that any man would make of God dishonors God. For this reason, there is not any singular image or picture that can accurately represent the total character of God. So every creation that is to represent God implicitly is inaccurate, because God is unlimited, and as soon as you erect or cast a statue or a likeness, you've limited God. Example, the children of Israel made a golden calf, did they not, in the wilderness? You know, that meant something to them. The golden calf represented strength because in Egypt they worshipped Apis the bull. And when Aaron and the rest of them created that bull, they were saying, our God is mighty. Our God is strong. He parted the Red Sea. The problem with that is that when you look at that ferocious bull, it tells you nothing of the love, the patience, the mercy, the long-suffering, or any of the moral characteristics of that God. So it dishonors God. It's not a complete picture. It also misleads men because it's a psychological fact that when your mind focuses on an image and you pray to that image, you begin to think of the person behind that image as what that image represents. So it can mislead a person because you've misrepresented God. So he says, look, God is a creator. He made everything. You can't make an image that represents God. And then fifthly, God is judge. In verse 30, truly, these times of agnosticism, ignorance, that's what it means, agnostic. The Latin equivalent of agnostic is ignoramus. It simply means to either be without knowledge or to refuse to accept the knowledge that is offered. This ignorance God has overlooked in the past, but notice this, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. Because he has appointed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by the man whom he has ordained, he has given assurance of this to all by raising him from the dead. Now, the Epicureans believed that death ends it all. The Stoics believed that life was just fatalistic. It was like karma. He's saying, let me tell you guys something. History is going somewhere, and that somewhere is the judgment seat of Jesus Christ. And to prove it, God raised this appointed Messiah from the dead. And he's appointed a day in which he will judge all men. So he boils it down to a personal decision. Gets down to brass tacks, you might say. God commands all men everywhere to repent. Notice that. It says God commands. He doesn't suggest it. God doesn't say, now look, I'm a big bearded essence in the sky, and I know that you're a product of your environment, and I am so understanding and loving that you can do anything you feel like, and I'll let you come in. And so Adolf Hitler, look, I know that you had a bad upbringing, and your mother dropped you when you were young, and these things happen, and because of what you did, I can understand your environment. The point is this, God overlooked ignorance in the past. God is a gracious God. God is a merciful God. God overlooked years of ignorance. But now, since Jesus has come, there is a commandment for all men everywhere to repent. Paul knew that wasn't popular. He knew that very soon because of the responses that he got from that. Let's look at the answer of the people finally. Verse 32. When they heard the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, while others said, we'll hear you again on this matter. So Paul departed from among them. The first response was rejection. Some mocked. Literal translation would be some of them sneered and even burst out laughing. I used to mock Christians. I really did. I didn't like them. I didn't like what they stood for. I didn't like what they represented. In fact, at one point, I even sought to evangelize a person out of becoming a Christian. And I was, unfortunately, pretty successful at one point. I didn't like them. I mocked. Every Christian who has stood up for something in history has been mocked. Abraham was mocked. Noah was mocked. The apostles were mocked. Jesus himself was mocked. Every martyr through history has been mocked. Jesus said it's going to happen. Jesus said as soon as the gospel hits certain hearts, Satan comes and snatches the seed that was sown in their hearts so that they don't believe. And they will mock. The second was not only rejection, that was the first response. The second response was what you might say is reflection or procrastination. Notice they said, we'll hear you again. They put it off. Now this is a dangerous position. Felix the governor, not Felix the cat. Felix the governor. Later on in the book of Acts, Paul stands before him in Caesarea and shares Jesus with him. And Felix says the same thing. He says, Felix was afraid and said, go away for now, for when I have a convenient time, I will call for you. Sometimes people will say, well, I'm not ready. Let me think it over. There's always tomorrow. Proverbs tells us, don't boast about tomorrow. You don't know what a day will bring. There's a story about the demons in hell having a conference. Three of them came forward and suggested to the devil, to Satan himself, how they would overthrow the world. The first one said, we shall convince them there is no God. Satan said, that won't work. There are people out there who, looking at the design, will infer a designer. The second demon said, well, then we'll tell them there's no afterlife. There's no heaven or hell. Satan said, well, that won't work because they'll say, if God created people, why did he create them for nothing at all? The third demon said, no, we'll tell them that there's a God. We'll tell them that there's an afterlife, but we'll tell them there's no hurry. And Satan said, you got it. Go out and destroy millions. Procrastination. We'll hear you again on this matter. The third response was a good response. It was reception. In verse 34, however, some joined and believed. Among them, Dionysius the Areopagite, a woman named Maris, and others with him. Now, the Areopagite was the intellectual aristocracy of their day. He was like one of the 30 brain governors of Athens. And he was tired of the empty philosophies of the Stoics. He was tired of Epicureanism and just live for pleasure. There's got to be something more to life. You know, I believe that people today say the same thing. I think there's questions that run around the brains of every single person. Where'd I come from? Why am I here? Where am I going? Science seeks to answer the first one. Where'd I come from? Philosophy tries to answer the second one. Why am I here? Only Jesus Christ can answer all three of them. Where did you come from? You were created by a big God in his image and likeness. Why am I here? To know this unknown God and to walk with him intimately. Three, where am I going? Well, that's entirely up to you. The choice is yours. Some rejected, some procrastinated, some received. There's a courthouse in the Midwest. It's up on a hill. It's got a pitched roof, and I hear that when it rains, that the rain falling on one side of the roof runs down the roof and empties out into the Great Lakes, runs out into the Atlantic Ocean. Rain falling on the other side will run down the hill, go down into the Ohio and the Mississippi rivers, and out into the Gulf of Mexico. One little breath of wind will change the eternal direction, so to speak, of that drop. Choices are like that when it comes to God. That little choice that you make now, that little choice about who Jesus is, about who this God is and your relationship to him, as Paul began with God and ended with man, will determine everything. God's overlooked a lot, but now he commands all men everywhere to repent.